Good evening, everybody. We'll start. That's lovely. We're on the go. I'm glad someone knows about laptops. Thanks for making it here. I think we're fairly crowded. Liz, could you shut that door and open the other door, and they can come through the other way? It's just going to be a bit easier than people coming in through the main door there. Right. We're quite lucky with the timing this week. I don't know whether any of you saw the Phillips report, the Hill report, which was produced last week, and that was the statistics from The Guardian. You may have heard that the book The Spirit Level has just been issued in paperback with revisions. If you haven't read the book, I can thoroughly recommend getting hold of it. And I see that Danny, when he recommended reading before you come on this particular event, you should have read The Spirit Level. And it's a very, very interesting book, and I can thoroughly recommend it. I'm sure Danny will say more about this. It's a humanist meeting. Humanists, basically, the ethics are based on accumulated experience and basically on evidence rather than on dogma. And one of the exciting things that I've been finding is that we're getting evidence of the problems that inequality produce. I suppose one could say it's actually reinforcing my prejudices, but I also think that the observation that inequality is actually damaging to people right the way across society is obviously a concern to people like us as humanists. Our speaker this evening is Danny Dorling. I've got a sneaking suspicion that a few of you have heard about him. He's Professor of Human Geography at Sheffield and numerous other places, I gather. I haven't got time to list them, I don't think, so I won't. He was a member of the academic reference group advising the ministers on the social mobility white paper, and he's now also on the World Health Organization Scientific Resource Group on Health Equity Analysis and Research. So in other words, very topical. The focus of his research is an understanding and mapping the changing social, political and medical geographies and how these affect the life chances and how the gaps may be narrowed. I've caught him a few times on Radio 4 battling with the presenters and trying to actually answer the question he wants to answer rather than give the answer they want him to give. So, without more ado, I shall hand over to Danny. And
we'll be ready in a few minutes.
He'll start anyway. Mm-hmm. When you start that, it's just a matter of starting off the slideshow and it can run automatically.
Yeah. Great, thank you ever so much. When the snow came down this evening, I thought there is a God, and the God doesn't want us to talk about inequality. I won't say anything else about God for the rest of my 30 minutes. I'm a child of Thatcher, so I'm going to try and sell you something, which is a book. So please just take one and pass it on, and give it to a librarian, because they have lots of money. This is a talk based on this book, The Book Isn't Yet Out. For the last 22 years, I've been looking at issues of inequality and mainly trying to measure them. About 22 years ago, a young researcher, medical researcher, handed me a tape, because computers had computer tapes back then, and she said something very bad's happening, young men are killing themselves in greater numbers, you need to have a look at this. And it was the government mortality data, which at that time was secret, and I looked at this and saw it was going up, it was getting worse, and was shocked by it. And then I've become less and less shocked by these kind of things over time, thinking health inequalities and wealth inequalities, which have been getting worse. So some things which have been getting better, and I'll go on about them in a minute.
It's right over here.
Some things that are getting better, but many things in terms of inequalities have been getting worse. When the slideshow comes on, it's just going to play itself automatically, give you something else to look at, so that I don't feel too intimidated by the fact you're forced to look at me at the moment. The Spirit Level, though. I was lucky enough 2 years ago to get to read The Spirit Level. The authors gave it me to try and check to see what mistakes they'd made. And I couldn't find them, so I'm a bit worried to hear the paperback edition is now coming out revised with corrections.
No, it's additions.
Okay, additions. Oh, yes. The Spirit Level, for those who don't know this, is a book which claims that amongst rich countries, and this is only true of rich countries, about 25 richest countries in the world, for those which are more unequal, which is us in the United States and Portugal and Singapore, much of life is worse for most people. That's the claim.
And the kind of thing that they list are how long you're going to live on average, life expectancy is lower, but also things like teenage pregnancies are higher, drug use is higher, mental ill health is worse. The trains actually don't run on time so well in unequal countries. Run very well in countries like Japan, which have very high rates of equality. But a long list of things. Now, I'm not going to talk about that. That's great. It'll just hopefully play itself and change. A little text comes up. This kind of tells you what I'm supposed to say, but I will now feel more free to have it on about what I want to say. I'm not going to try and convince you that unequal countries are bad. I'm going to assume that you are largely of that disposition. You won't all be, but most of you are probably leftish and don't like inequality that much. What I want to talk about is the question about why do we accept it at this level? Why doesn't it go down? Why do we live at these high rates of inequality, given how bad they appear to be to so many people? Given that inequality wasn't this bad in Britain 40 years ago, given it's not this bad in most countries in the rich world, which I think is the most important thing. So I'm not talking about some utopia here about wouldn't it be nice if we could all be equal. I'm interested in why aren't we like the average person in the average OECD country. What is that? Various slides are going to appear. The way I kind of try to structure my answer is by taking Beveridge's five evils, which were idleness, let me get them right in order. Ignorance, want, idleness, squalor, and disease. What I want to try and argue with you is that in place of those five evils, which are still there, but in many ways have been tackled to a large extent, there aren't that many, there still are significant, there's not that many illiterate young people nowadays, new things have arisen. And they've particularly arisen in the most unequal of countries, in the place of those evils. Ultimately, one of the worst things, or most pernicious things, is that the quality of public discussion and thought is worse in more unequal countries. And this creates a huge problem, because if your ability to talk about what it is that you're dealing with is harmed by living in an unequal country, the classic state would be the United States, where half the population still don't vote or are not allowed to vote by law, even for the president of the election of Barack Obama. If your basic processes of thought are damaged by growing up in a very unequal country, it becomes hard to change things. To give you a practical example of this, luckily, I was lucky enough about 2 years ago, 1.5 years ago, to be interviewing young people and children in Japan and asking them about inequality with the help of a interpreter. As we said, I can't speak Japanese. And the amazing thing to me about doing that was asking poor children in Japan what they thought about income distributions and what they thought the income distribution was, and what was the average income of an average Japanese family, the worst off fifth, the best off fifth, and so on. And I found, unless my interpreter was lying incredibly well, I could ask questions of relatively poor children in Japan I couldn't ask of average children in this country. And it's not just Japan. Japan's a useful example because we normally talk about Scandinavia as being an equal country. There's just this difference in what people are up to. And children leave at 18 in Japan and have done for a long time. This is an example of the kind of thing I think is going on which is wrong. These curves are how the OECD say the distribution of ability is amongst children in these different countries. And you might recognise them. These are bell curves. The reason they're bell curves isn't because children have that kind of ability distribution. The reason they're bell curves is that the OECD economists, everything is done by economists in the OECD, the Organisation of Rich Countries, they decided it was going to be a bell curve before they actually got the data. Right? It's hidden in one of their technical notes, but they decided you wouldn't get curves of that shape. And we still have, particularly amongst economists, or a group of economists who became very powerful in economics, ideas that there are these kind of curves, lots of people who are not very able and a few super able human beings and so on. What I'm going to try and argue with you is that these ideas have become stronger in countries like Britain and the United States, and they're much more flattened off in countries where people are more equal. I won't talk about all of these, but it's always useful to look at women if you want to look about how people have been treated badly. These are the women who are given Nobel Peace Prizes, about 5% a year. The reason for showing you this is, if you're sceptical about change being possible, the Remarkable Peace Prizes this year were not Barack Obama's prize. President of America getting the prize is normal. The remarkable thing that happened in 2009 was that a third of the prizes went to women. That's never happened before. The first prize in economics went to a woman after 62 prizes going to men. So remember, this is your normal level, about 5%, slightly higher then, higher in the 40s, none in the 50s, not one. Committees couldn't even fix a single token woman out of five prizes a year every year for about 14 years. And then suddenly, you've got to extend that up to 30% for what happened. I'm not saying it improves everything, but don't think that things cannot suddenly change. Elitism in education. Try and put yourself back to 1942 or 1944 with the Act of Parliament that created secondary school education for all. Or even back to the time when we were arguing for comprehensive schools so you could all go to your nearest school. And now try and imagine today and say, we created a system where 36% of young people will now go to university, but those places are for the young people with the most qualifications. And what we do is we give them more qualifications, then they can do master's degrees and get more qualifications. And we're spending the bulk of our educational money on those who are best treated at the beginning, because we think they're the ones we're going to get real value from. It would have been quite hard to imagine that in 1942, you'd end up with a situation of spending so much on a minority of young people. My other favourite statistic about education in Britain is that we spend the second highest amount of our budget on private education in the world after Chile. Chile spends a higher portion of its budget, secondary and primary, on private. We spend, I think it's about 30% of the money we spend on primary and secondary education is spent privately on just 7% of children. Even the United States of America, which has other ways in which it segregates, doesn't do that. The sector is tiny in France and Germany. And the results are people just do better. Oh, a last statistic. I'll try not to throw statistics at you. Tony Blair. Oh, God. That's Tony mentioning God. Another statistic, my last one on education. The city of Sheffield sends 24% of its children to university. It's one of the poorer large cities in Britain. The city of Bristol, one of the richer large cities in Britain, sends 23% of its children to university. We know this very, very accurately because we know the home postcode of every child who gets into university because they get their postcode correct on their locus form. So why does Sheffield get an extra child into university compared to Bristol? Very simple thing. What's the difference, if any? You know, the difference between Sheffield and Bristol for education?
Private schools.
Sheffield's got very few. Bristol has a huge number of private schools. The effect on overall chances of the children in Bristol is actually to reduce their chances overall. I grew up in the city of Oxford. After Liverpool and Hull, the third city where you're most likely to leave school as a boy without qualification is Oxford. It's been identified as a city underserved by universities by the government. If you go to one of the five comprehensives in Oxford, you do not tend to go to university. Oxford Old Nation certainly don't take you. Oxford Brookes quotes on their website that they take 20% of their intake from Oxfordshire, but they won't say how many they take from Oxford. And the problem with Oxford, lots and lots of private schools. And this is a problem for liberal academics. The liberal academics of Oxford are not sending their children to the posh comprehensive. They're paying for them to go privately because they can't organise themselves to all go in one year. They've got enough children. Right? I mean, this is an example of the sort of stupidity and what it gets like if you live in an unequal country. To end up the city of Oxford having an appalling education record for its children, who end up being servants for universities and changing beds. It's just not sensible. The difficulty is, I think, and I'm very happy to argue a debate with this, after four decades of rising inequality, you get stuck in ways of thinking. If you do very well at university, or you become a leader of a political party, it's very easy to begin to convince yourself that you are specially able. There is something special about you, and your children. You deserve lots of money. I'm not just thinking of Tony Blair, but he's a nice example to use this. And there are a group of other people like you, particularly your own children, who need to be looked after and spent lots of money on. And because you're so specially able, you need bigger incentives to work, to reward you for that talent you've got. And it's not just Tony Blair. I mean, it's university professors, to be honest. University professors go and argue their salaries up. I'll try not to dig myself in any further holes as I'm that near to my university. This is old stuff about where these ideas came from, but they're very recent. This is only 1891. This is the world's first ever histogram of people, and it's the curve of paupers who were receiving money under the poor law. And it was drawn by a man to try and claim that paupers bred paupers, that they were genetically inferior and genetically superior human beings. What we've largely learnt in the last 10 or 15 years about ability is you're not born with a fixed ability. This is the consensus of the majority of scientific opinion coming out on this. You're born with an enormous number of neurons that you can't largely connect anyway, so we don't have pens that we use up. We're also born very unable to think. We're not actually that good at thinking. The classic experiment on this was one in which a group of students were divided into two and told they're going to be tested on something. One group were given a two-digit ID number to remember and then go and do the test. The other group were given a five-digit ID number to remember, 75425, and they just try to remember it. And then when they went to the test, you completely ignored the test results. The trick was to see which ones managed to do were better or worse, and the ones who had to remember the five-digit ID number just couldn't do the test, because this part of our brain isn't that good. But you're taught to think that you're especially clever and so on. And of course, if somebody gives you lots of A's and more A's, and they give you a high salary, and they call you leader, or whatever, it's easy to begin to delude yourself. It's much harder to do that in a more equal country, where people will put you down and tell you, don't be so silly, you're like us. What we are beginning to discover is that human beings appear to be different from other mammals in that we are born earlier, we're born particularly helpless, and we're born remarkably plastic. Mammals in general are born plastic. There are nasty experiments on rats where baby rats are taken away from mummy rats, and they grow up to be nasty, vicious rats. Or baby rats are kind of cuddled and looked after, and they grow up to be sociable rats. And similar things happen with us. But we are not born with a kind of ability schedule. I'll try and show you this one. This is about poverty and falling in and out of it. In Britain, we have very wide income distributions, very wide distributions about how much people spend on things. And one problem is that people spiral around this kind of thing like this. And as your income goes up, you don't spend more straight away, but you get used to it, begin to spend more. You lose your job, you don't immediately take your spending down. You carry on, you cut back a bit, but not as much as your income cut back, and you get into debt, and you go down and around again. That kind of spiral in Britain is far, far bigger, wider, than it is in countries where the income inequalities are far lower. In Japan and Iceland, the poorest fifth of the population, the day labourers, people serving coffee in shops, earn three times less than the best of fifth. In Britain, the poorest fifth earns seven times less than the best off fifth. It's the difference between being a fool if you go to work and take your job seriously if you're badly paid, and having some fun in it, which you see if you get to see how people behave in other countries. People are they're taking the mickey once they pay you seven times less than somebody else. When you want to work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Monday and Tuesday to earn what somebody else earns, but probably sitting in an office having a nice time travelling and enjoying themselves. That's the difference. America is 8-1. In France and Germany it's about 4 or 5-1. In Iceland it's 3-1. That's the worldwide distribution. Just in case anybody's feeling particularly hard done by, the average salary in the world is about $4,000 a year, and we're all up here. But we don't all celebrate this, because when you get to a certain level of wealth in a country, level that Richard Wilkerson and Kate Cook would argue we got to several years ago, your income isn't any longer about satisfying material needs. It's not about buying food. It's not about buying shelter, although 1 in 10 people can't heat their house adequately. But we've gone past that. On average, poor people now don't get thinner, they get fatter. It's a completely new change. But income matters incredibly. It matters more than ever because it's about how much people respect you. How much people pay you is how much they respect you. Especially in an unequal country like we are, where the pay differences are minor. Where the pay is much, much similar and the benefits are livable on, which is another thing that goes in an unequal country, your benefit levels shoot down, and the middle class try to imagine not living on benefit levels, then it really begins to matter. So, I'll try and give some structure to this. In the last 40 years, we've become more elitist in terms of education. There are 40 universities in Britain that now try and claim to be in the top 10 in the world. I mean, it's just, it's embarrassing, it's stupid, it's silly, and I have to be very careful what I say because I work in the university. And that's sad, if you think about it. But there we have it.
I won't start saying nice things about my university because I'll sound completely hypocritical.
Exclusion is necessary. We've come to believe that a group of people are always going to be pretty poor, despite the fact we're one of the richest countries in the world. And we're going to have to keep a group pretty poor and not pay them very much to make them want to get out of bed to work because they're so feckless. This has become a normal way of talking about people. So we have an obsession with people not claiming benefits they're not entitled to and so on. Whereas the tax that isn't paid is many, many hundreds of times greater than that. Surveys over 20 years, a quarter of people are finding it difficult to manage. Half the population say they're coping. It's the richest country on earth, one of the richest countries on earth. A quarter finding it difficult to manage and half say they're coping. It's just not a sensible way to be doing things. And they partly say they're coping, or largely say they're coping, not because they don't actually have enough money, but because they know about these people who have free cars and take free holidays, and whose children they can go to university and they can pay all those that money and that cost to go to university and so on and on. That's what makes you only be able to cope. Far more equal income distribution than you decide that you're pretty well off because you're like everybody else. And this country was like that in the past. It wasn't a utopia. It was much worse for women. It was much more overtly racist. Yes, some things have got better, but changes have happened. Some graphs. This is the concentration of the Conservative vote. This is how many voters you'd have to move around the country if you wanted to spread them and have an even concentration of Conservatives. They were very concentrated in 1918. They become less concentrated by 1960s, the most even spread of Conservatives. It's not their vote, it's not how well they did, it's how concentrated they are. And they're becoming more and more and more concentrated. That's going to go up again because the biggest rise of Cameron will be in the south of England. It's absolutely sure of it. You're being told, save £200 on the mortgage, vote for me. People in the South of England will vote for it. People in the city of one of the highest rates of public sector employment are unlikely to vote for Cameron and his name numbers. But I want to show you this graph. I'm going to show you a couple more, just because of how smooth it is. We had a smooth change. This is the proportion of income that goes to the richest 1%. Way back in 1918, it was about 18% going to the richest 1% of people. This is before tax and after tax. That came down. It came down because they were paid and received more. Death duties and other things brought it down even faster after tax. And then from around about the same time, mid-1970s, it goes up and up and up and up. The last 2 years of bankers' bonuses have, for me at least, I'm the one person who's happy about the bankers' bonuses because it gets my little dot back up to 1918. The average income of the country went up last year only because of bankers' bonuses. Quite incredible, but this is a long-term change. It's not really about any particular political party, if you think about it. I mean, there were differences. I'll show you death rates in a minute where... But we had 40 or 50 years of increasing equality, and then we had this huge wobble in the 70s where I would argue we could have gone one way or the other, and we chose one way, other countries chose another, and then increases. This is inequality and mortality. It starts off high. Mass unemployment in the 30s creates this. Comes way down, went up with 30 years Conservative government, which just came down again, and then up and up and up and up, what we have now. Again, it's kind of U-shaped. It's a slow and steady change. I mean, you wouldn't know that there'd been an election of a different government in 1997, to be honest. Although they claim they achieved this, it's hard to tell We currently have the widest inequality in life expectancy that we've been able to measure. About 12, 13 years between districts now, at the extreme. I'm not saying that things haven't got better. Average health has got better. But it's got better fastest in the constituencies where it was best to begin with. The people whose life chances increased the most since 1997 voted Conservative. This wasn't a conspiracy. Labour government didn't sit around in the room and say, let's get people to vote for us and then we'll increase the life expectancy of Conservative voters the most. There were long-term things going on. I think one useful thing to think about when you're thinking about, I'm worried about inequality and you might be saying, but look, the overall standard is rising, is try and pretend you're in the 1930s. And I could have stood in front of you in the 1930s and said, look, it's great, compare ourselves with 1901, where we had infant mortality rates of a quarter of babies dying in the summers around about 1901, 1905. Look what an improvement there's been between 1901 and 1936. Stop complaining, it's great. The problem is, if you do that, you wouldn't have had what we had in the 1940s and 50s, which was a revolution in terms of how people were treated, what it was like to be alive. Greed is good. I've only got five of these, so you can begin to see the end. I better probably curtail this a bit faster than that. There really still is a mantra in Britain of greed is good. It's very, very curtailed and hidden now, but it's still really need the banks to become back into private hands again because only greed works. My favourite quote is on page 336 of Robert Peston's book, the BBC Economics Editor, where he says he waits till then before he says it because he hopes nobody who doesn't believe in him will read that far. He says, actually, greed is still good and we need it. We need people to be greedy to make it all work. And he's a dominant figure in the BBC. Whether he'd still say that now, I don't know. Greed being bad. 7% of single adults own two or more cars. You can't drive. Well, I'd like to see somebody try and drive more than one car at a time. It's quite complicated to work this out, but basically the majority of children in a household without a car have a mum and no dad. And if you have small children, you will know, I mean, you also need a car, it's helpful to have a car if you're in a wheelchair, you can't get around, but it's also very helpful if you've got young children. We do have families that need cars, we have people who have got more cars than they need, we're getting worse and worse and worse in Sheringham Town. We have 120 million bedrooms. And I went to annoy people, I get worried when people talk about council house building programmes, because we actually have enough houses. What we don't have is a right to sell your house if you get into bad times. This is the debt in the USA rising, which when I drew this about 3 years ago, I was very excited about, and wondered whether people would believe me, and now it's a very boring graph. And it is interesting, I think, you get used to your circumstances. You get very, very used to how you live. You think it's normal. We don't say we live in one of the most unequal countries in the world, where unlike most rich countries, you don't go to your local university, you skip across the country, so you can join another set of people like you. We don't say that. We say, this is Britain, it is normal. Similarly, you say, this is 2010, this is normal. It's very hard to think back, even 3 years, about what was being said then, and say how strange it is now. See what's going on. The international finances are unbelievable at the moment. The changes that are going on in the amount of money being lent in America, Americans are paying back their mortgages, net. The first time ever, they're paying back more than they're borrowing. Never happened before. We've had no idea what's going to happen. On those couple of days when Liam and brothers went, the people who knew, which was a tiny number, seriously thought the system would come down. I'm not making this up, it's just that they tell people like me 6 months later, when they feel fairly safe, that it wasn't going to collapse. But they really were scared. It was an unprecedented effect. And I truly believe if it had come down, it would have been awful. I'm personally not into revolution and I think many people have died and starved and so on. I'm very glad that they did what they did. I just wish we'd now do something else rather than trying to get back to where we were. This is the benefit thing, this is Australia, but the figure for Britain is even more amazing because it comes down. This is the amount of money that Australians steal from the benefit, and this is how much they don't pay in taxes. But the figure for Britain is even more staggering. These people are the entrepreneurial, brilliant businessmen that bring us jobs and wealth, and these are scum of the earth. My slides are taking longer on this machine than others, but
so I ought to start asking you what you think.
But I'll just tell you about the last set of slides that go up here, which are about distress. One of the best things that happened in the Beveridge Report and that Labour government in 1945 was the NHS. The best effects of the NHS actually occurred before 1948, before it began. And there were suicide rates amongst L people came down, they more than halved in 3 years. Because elderly people knew they were going to get a health service. They didn't actually have to give them a health service, just knowing that you were going to get it, and that things had changed. Half the suicide rate of the elderly. We didn't bring in the NHS because we were rich. We were bankrupt. It's actually a very cheap way of providing healthcare. And if you're being optimistic about things, we are fairly near to bankruptcy now. It's incredibly expensive, it's inequality. Rich people cost a lot of money, which they use very inefficiently on what they do with it. And I'm not, again, what I'm arguing for is I wish we would have an aspiration that said, can we be as unequal as the average unequal country in the OECD, please? Not can we be some wonderful country, or can we be a shining light to everybody else. Can we aim to have an equality of income and wealth that's the same as the average rich person has? At the moment, you're not allowed to ask that. There is a campaign group called One Society, funded by rich people, they're not all bad, which is trying to get parliamentary candidates of all parties to sign up to wanting racial equality. But it's currently the dominant thought still that actually Britain does rather well out of inequality. It makes us strong, it makes us have the best banks in the world, and so on. The best scientists. We're innovative because of it, and other things. One awful thing about all of this is what happens to mental health. This is the mental health of girls in North America over time. This one is actually more obvious. This is Prozac being taken in Scotland. That's 1 in 10. So it was curtailing. They were managing to reduce the amount of Prozac. It went up fourfold from about 1992 to 2006, higher in Glasgow. But of course, that's shot up since the recession. It's mass medication of a population. I'm not saying it doesn't work, or I won't get into what Prozac does. But this is not something to be particularly proud of. We have increased in anxiety, despair, stress. We have it amongst our 15-year-olds. It's higher in North America and Britain. It has not gone up in the half of the OECD, which is more equal, from the trials that have been done. And it's because of this competitive environment we're putting people into, where if you are a young person now, there is a small chance you might do very well. You never know, you might get an X Factor or so on. But unless you're very, very deluded, and it's easy to be very deluded, you're not going to get that. Then, of course, there's a chance you might do well in traditional ways as seen as doing well, which might be going to university. But if you come from a middle-class household, well, you're just expected to do that. So you just have to worry about failing to get into university. And if you come from a poorer household, well, your chance is only about 1 in 10, 1 in 8, so you've not got a good chance. And if you have society strung out like this, this huge difference in terms of where you could end up, it's just scary for somebody who's young. In a way, it wasn't scary for my parents and their grandparents, who saw a world coming together. The Hill's report, this is death rates now of young men are zooming up. But inequalities is creating bigger inequalities than cigarettes did in terms of this one. The Hill's report, the most amazing thing in the Hill's report was hidden in it because the statistics were too shocking for them to think that they could get past the threats. So the Hill's report led on these 3-to-1 inequalities and income 4-to-1, measuring large groups of the population. The most shocking stuff was the stuff on wealth, and the one that was most shocking of all was the wealth inequality in London. 1 in 10 Londoners have individual wealth that's tied up in their pensions, but it is real money, life insurance equity. 1 in 10, not household, but individual wealth of almost £1 million. Another 1 in 10 Londoners have individual wealth of about £3,000. The ratio was 273-1. Not 27%, not 2 times, not 27 times. 273-1 wealth differences for large groups of the population. Now, as far as I can tell, and I haven't had enough time to look or search, but I'm willing to bet at least 1 pint from far below that you won't be able to find another city outside of slavery which is as unequal as London has become now. the solutions are in many ways sort of fairly obvious. I mean, you know, the nice thing about having too much money is you can find things to do with it, and you know, we know who needs to lose it, and there are ways in which we can get them to lose it, some which might be better than others. But I think before we can even get to that position, we have to get to a point where people think that this is bad. And at the moment, the majority of people, particularly at the very top of society, think that they're benefiting other people by being 273 times richer than them. That's a tenth of the population. So when you're thinking that Tony Blair is being very nasty, taking his 5 million or 10 million a year, he's representative of a significant large group of people who talk to each other and have come to believe, by the way they've been brought up and taught, his tutors in Oxford write papers about genetic differences. It's not entirely there. It's not, I don't know, I'll be nice to Blair, but it's not, you could put another child in that same circumstance. He was born in the same year as Thatcher's children. I have a theory that they were swapped, but anyway. I'll let this carry on going, and I'll shut up in about 1 minute. I have at the end of this a sort of series of things I suggest. I've got 2 copies of slides if anybody's feeling very cheated that I haven't gone through them. There are a whole number of things that you can do, but you won't get to do any of them until you decide that this inequality is not good for people, including not good for the rich. 1 in 3 of the daughters of the richest 10% of people suffer anxiety and depression. And I think it's about 1 in 8 are self-harming physically, meaning they're being admitted to hospital because of the cutting on their arms. So children of the rich. The MPs don't talk about their children. MPs are rich. An MP's household, you're looking at an income of about £200,000 for the pair of the couple, because it's normally a well-paid partner as well. I don't think their children are having particularly good lives. But they all blame it on themselves. They don't talk about it. If something went wrong, so great embarrassment. You're not allowed to do research on the collected children of MPs. You can't get them. But wouldn't it be great if you could? So you can just turn around to MPs and say, look at the mental health, the anxiety of your children, their concerns, and how terrible it is for them compared to 40 years ago. It is in your direct self-interest as a member of Parliament and a fairly rich person to begin to change it. Forget about being nice to your constituents and going to your surgery. Selfishly, just for you, it's in your interest to begin to change things, to be more like most countries in the OECD and a bit less like the United States, Portugal and Singapore. That's the way the argument's trying to go. I think trying to explain to affluent and powerful people it's in their own personal self-interest is worthwhile doing. You might think it's a bit of a morally corrupt argument, but it appears the most interesting evidence in the spirit level is the evidence about the achievement in education, the life expectancy of the best off in society. If I cared enough for my children, I should move my family, if I could, to Japan or to Sweden or to Germany or France. And if I really don't care for them, I should take a job, if there were any jobs, which they're not, going into university in the United States. The country you're brought up in has this huge effect on your life chances. It triples the chances of mental ill health. I have 3 children. One of them is probably going to suffer from very poor mental ill health. It doesn't help having an average professor, to be honest, on this kind of thing. That's the most significant fear I ought to have. And if I really cared about it and didn't care about everybody else here, it would make a lot of sense to move to somewhere where people are a lot more sorted, which is just moving to most other bits of the rich world. The problem I've got, most of you got, I only speak one language, and those countries that speak this language, that are rich, are not that dissimilar to Britain. And we've looked at them, we haven't looked at mainland Europe, we haven't looked at Korea, we haven't looked at Japan to see how things can operate differently. Thank you very much for listening to me so patiently.
I'd very much like to thank Danny for what I found was a really fascinating lecture. One little bit of the equation I didn't see highlighted is the thing I've always felt is that wealth on its own is worth very, very little. It's only when it starts to buy power, which of course is the big problem of trying to shift it. Are there many people here who would like a comfort break? If so, I can try to arrange one, but I'd rather not break up the flow if we don't have to. Is anyone desperate? One of us. So shall we carry on? And is everyone warm enough? And I'll turn the heater off because it's a bit noisy. Are people warm enough?
Yes.
Right. For those of you who haven't been before, we usually have about half an hour's discussion now. Can you indicate if you want to speak by just putting your hands up? I'll give a nod and just make a quick note, but then I'll actually ask you to speak, particularly when you've got a large number. We just try to give everyone a fair chance of making a contribution. So just hand up. Don't, when I say yes, think that's the go-ahead to speak. No, I'll actually ask you to speak. So, I can see your hand already. Mark.
Do you want me to speak now?
Yes, yes. Someone's going to start.
Can I ask two questions?
Yes.
Forgive me if you've already covered this. I missed the first 15 minutes because of the snow. You presented a lot of figures, and you're obviously an expert on this. What do you see as the cause of this, and what can we do about it? That's the first question. And the other question is, I've thought for a number of years that somebody ought to do, an economist ought to do some research into possibly proving, in terms of economics, that a more equal society is actually better in terms of economics.
Okay.
And that, you know, because that's what wins arguments in terms of politics and economics. Yes. You know, hard facts and, you know.
Can I quickly do that?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, I was bumbling. The causes. I mean, what's happened to Japan was it lost a war. And what we're not taught about is what happened when it lost a war. The Americans were very worried about Japan becoming communist. So what they did is get rid of the aristocracy by redistribution of land. Now, if you imagine somebody had invaded Britain and redistributed the land 45 years ago, we haven't had our land redistributed for 1,000 years. One of the causes is simply circumstance. In that this country had a small invasion in the Glorious Revolution, but didn't change very much, and it's been a very unequal country for a long time. A second circumstance is simply how powerful we were economically. We were a world empire, and it's part of the reason why America is this uneven, because it was so powerful. So it's historical circumstance. But then it was choices made in the 70s or late 60s, and it was knife edge. The 1974 elections were key. There were, let me go back further, say, in the 30s, straight after the crash, there were choices to be made, and again we had a series of elections. I think we're going to get more than one election now. Eventually that resulted in a landslide Labour victory, but the battle was almost won before then. That's why the Beveridge Report came out. In the 70s, it swung either way, but there was a crucial vote in October 74, which was the beginning of the move of the South towards Conservatives. And the decision was made, if you like, to ditch the North and to concentrate power by enough people. But it could have gone the other way. There were these knife-edge moments. This country is naturally conservative, naturally unequal, because of how rich it's been and how unequal it's been for a long time. We're at a similar position now. I mean, there's a small chance we could carry on as we are, but that seems unlikely. We could have a series of right-wing government victories and concentrate everything on a group of small people around about Notting Hill and Chelsea and a few houses near Whitby. Try and bring our banking system back up to an echo of what it was in the past and jettison the north of England, jettison poor people and so on. That's an option. It's not impossible to imagine it. We could alternatively try not to resurrect the banking system to what it was before. Become poorer, but become more equal. And that could happen. It's not going to happen at this election, but it could happen in 2 years' time or in 4 years' time. But I think that's my reason for that. Productivity, in the spirit level, they claim that productivity rates are higher in more equal countries. I don't go on about it because I think these countries are rich enough anyway. And we don't need 2, 3, or 4% growth rates. Japan has managed fairly well on a growth rate near 1%, and it's still a very nice country to be in. the most likely thing to happen to you in Japan if you go and visit it? If you look at the Home Office website, can you guess what the advice is? Most likely crime?
Bitten.
No, it's not actually a crime. The most common reason somebody has to visit the British Embassy in Japan. 80 people had to do it last year. Worst thing that happened, you lost your passport. Hardly any prisons, no crime. Similar in Finland, similar in Norway. Whereas the United States, there are 2 million people in prison. The only country in the world that gets anywhere near the United States imprisonment rate is Rwanda, and that was only when they had all the war criminals locked up. These are just hugely different circumstances to be in. I'm not saying any of them are perfect, but it's just very different.
There was someone over there, I'll wait before we have another chance, Mark. There was someone over here who indicated right at the start, and I didn't put them down, I thought it was you, yes.
I'm unclear on both what you're actually proposing and also what you're saying the solutions are. You seem to be hostile to the idea of some kind of aspiration of society, but at the same time saying that that might be the only solution to these kind of problems.
Okay. Now, we should have an aspiration to be more equal. And the more equal countries have higher, better standards of education for everybody. They do, I don't want to be mean, I'm sure there'll be an American in the room. But the standard American student who paid to get into an elite college comes and tells you how high their GPA score is and then says other things, and they're not actually that able to do things. Whereas when we bring in students from Europe, I'm just shocked. I've always been shocked. There's 15 years I've had various students from Europe. Just how their English is better than mine. I mean, how they can just do things, and you know, there is a difference. And again, just the standard in Japan of education. So it's about aspirational. They're doing better. We don't aspire to do that well. I would just like to aspire to even understand that there is something better to aspire to, which we could easily have. University finances have been thrown out to a committee. The committee is going to report after the election. We could very easily have variable fees, because we are facing almost £1 billion cuts in universities. So you have to pay £7,000 a year if you want to go to a Russell Group university. So essentially, we're going to privatise our universities. That's not aspirational. Having universities that you get into if mum and dad have got the cash. I mean, it's and I don't think it's even good.
Tax break.
What's that?
Or if there was a corresponding tax break.
It just seems to me silly to pile debt onto young people and to have a system whereby what you study or are allowed to study depends on how rich your parents are.
Money still has to come from somewhere. It seems to live on this idea that the government has its own money, doesn't it? The money's generated by taxpayers.
Well, I'd look at how most countries do it.
Tax the rich. The rich are leaving the country now.
Good.
Yeah. I'm sure you enjoy the country.
But I just look at how most OECD countries do it. That's what I'm saying. How they fund their education systems that manage to produce better results than our education system.
Okay, Richard.
You spoke about disabilities earlier. I think this is one of the greatest inequalities. People do have different abilities. Some people are good at maths, some people are better off with their hands. And it's the expression of those abilities which is the important thing. We do recognise people who are good at maths. We do not recognise a carpenter. It would take me an awful lot of effort to become a carpenter. But for what I'm doing now, I'm recognised because I've been through the university system. And that says I have succeeded. And even at the school level, people are forced to go through a curriculum that does not allow them to express fully what they are good and better and more able to actually do. I mean, you can think, people like Jamie Oliver, very famous now as a chef on TV, but that's all he was, a cook. And if you're not cut on the TV, or you've not got the personality to actually express himself fully, he would just be a cook somewhere else. And so what I'm sort of saying, this is a major, major form of inequality. We do not recognise the difference between those who go on to what Cameron has called the, well, it's referred to the first and the second class degrees, i.e. those that are not what would be formally recognised as sort of academic subjects. And this is what, and it's this sort of lack of recognition of people's actual overall ability,
yes,
contribution to the society.
But I'd agree, but,
yeah,
but that's in Canada, in the Netherlands, in Germany, in Korea, cooks are paid relatively more and bankers are paid relatively less.
Mm. Yeah.
And then it's easier to be proud of doing that. What happens is that the jobs at the bottom disappear. I even saw this. So you have fewer men picking up the dustbins. You actually have a robotic arm picking up the dustbins. You have far more things served by machine, rather than having somebody whose job all day long is to serve something. So your bottom line, most countries have more equal income distributions, which means that those jobs which aren't respected are respected because they're paid more, and the jobs where people are overpaid are paid less. But they're not so annoyed about it, because the main thing that people who are paid well worry about is other well-paid people's salaries. So GPs are arguing for £120,000 a year because they're worried that some architect is getting it, and the architect is worried that some MP's family are getting it. They're worried. They not actually don't need 120. That's not. You know how annoyed people get when they find out what somebody else is paid? Yeah, that's it's, and it hurts, because we have an innate sense of our rank and how much we are respected. We have a, this is almost built into us. You know, some things are built in, because we're designed to look at how people around us are treating us and so on, because it's deadly to be ostracised, to be left out. And that's, so I would agree with you, but the way I would do it is to say we should have an income distribution, and that way people don't end up doing useless jobs. In fact, the jobs where people don't really want to do them end up going.
It's a recognition that abilities are equal. They may be expressed differently, but they are equal. That will lead to that wage equality of wage or income
distribution. If I take the next comment in the chat shirt there.
Yeah, thank you for the talk, it's really interesting. I'm a bit kind of concerned that, and it tends to be kind of people in economics who argue this, that our best hope is to argue for rationality from the rich. And we don't have a very good history as human beings of doing things that are in our best interests rationally. And actually, as far as I can think, the only things that ever motivate the rich to go against their own interests or to be rational, to share money out, are things that are essentially delusional. So things like patriotism or religion, where there's something else that people can attach themselves to in order to redistribute. Whenever we have rationalism, the rich tend to be very afraid, because of what you said, because of this kind of social rank idea that we have.
Yes.
The rich want to stay there. And even if you tell them that you'll be much better off, your children will be better off, if you share this out, that the whole country will be better off, the fear is too great. The fear is that if they let it go, no one else will leave and will let it go as well, and they'll be the ones left. And I wonder if appealing to rationality is not our best hope, that there may be another way.
I'm going to keep moving through the floor for a bit. The person in the green T-shirt there. To your left. Oh, I thought you did.
No.
In that case, I'll take the next person. Then is you?
Okay, thank you. I mean, I take the point of the previous questioner. What we actually do need is income compression, isn't it? So we need not a minimum wage. We need a maximum wage, and we also need a maximum wage cap, and that needs to be done through the tax system.
Mm.
Now, I've often actually thought that it would do the middle class a hell of a lot of good to be kicked in the wallet. That is, the initial shock would be actually rather bad, but as I think you illustrated in the course of your speech, of your lecture rather, a lot of well-off people are actually not very happy, and there's quite a lot of evidence for that. But we're stuck with this enduring question: how do we get from here to there? In a society which has got a very rigid class structure, which is getting even more and more rigid, where cultural capital is controlled by the rich, of course, because, as Bourdieu pointed out, you know, money buys influence, money transfers into power. And the question has to be, and I know I'm quite tempted to invade it if people ask me, so I don't want to put you on the spot, but how do we get from here to there, given that, as you just pointed out, the rich will not budge?
Okay. I'll carry on taking a few more points and then get Danny to give me any comments on that. The person, you. Yes.
Yeah, you've suggested that we should aspire to be a more equal society, but throughout the course of your talk, you've suggested that we should do this by lowering the richest people. So, in a sense, that we should bring them down rather than bringing the other people up.
No, no, just their money. Everything else about them would go up. They'd live longer, they'd learn more.
Shall I finish my problem first? So, bring their money down in an attempt to level the playing field, rather than bringing the quality and standards of the lowest people up. Now, surely, and it has been said a couple of times throughout the questions, that people see this to be done through taxation, tax the rich to bring them up, but this whole argument, I do believe in a fairer society, but to me it seems to be a negative argument, because you're talking about bringing people down rather than bringing people up, and you're victimising the rich and you're almost penalising the rich for being rich. That's actually the flip side of what Britain did during the Industrial Revolution, when we penalised the poor for being poor, when we introduced the poor reforms. Now, surely if you should learn one thing from history, you should penalise people from being whatever way they are. And it seems almost contradictory to the message you're sending out, that we should penalise people in a way that we appear to have learned
through penalising
people.
Yes,
three points?
Yes, I can only remember three at most. Remember about Ukrainians. These bits are only 60,000 years old. The last bit of us that you know, evolved. It's not that good. It's my excuse always. I do take a point. I'll try and answer all of them. I mean, the thing to remember is what we did in the 30s and the 40s. We did it before. We brought the inequalities down before. We did it by death duties.
Is that needed war?
It's not. We don't. You can't run many models of history, so we don't know whether it could have happened without a war. We do know that there were many attempts to recharge what was happening in the 30s, and they were failing before a war. So we don't know that the war. We don't know the war was essential. And a lot of my curves begin getting much, much better to 1939. I mean, a lot of the game was to 1939. You just didn't feel like it in the 30s. You didn't notice that. And a lot of the rich families lost their sons in the First War. One thing which is different now, if you look at Roundtree's report of York in 1901, one thing that shocks me is that the richest, the servant-keeping classes, lost 1 in 10 of their babies in the first year of life. They had that infant mortality rate. Now, when you had a situation like that, I could see why you wouldn't give up things, because to become more equal in 1901 or even 1922 did actually mean deprivation of some kind for the affluent. Now, for the rich, giving up a little bit of their wealth means giving up nothing that gives them any actual happiness. And we've gone way, way beyond what you need in terms of clothes and so on. I would agree with you, they may well not do it. The example I used to give of this was pop stars, and it's a bit doesn't work so well now, but it was ABBA and Michael Jackson. ABBA chose to stay in Sweden, and so one of them lives in a four-bedroom house. It's a fairly normal house, admittedly on a kind of nice island, but they decided to pay the tax and stay in Sweden. And although they're still paying tax, Bono went off. I'm waiting for Bono to die because his doctor does something dodgy to him to show you it's not worth being rich in America. But in fact, the death rates of the super rich in America is pretty awful. Their children, they die planes down, cocaine, the rest of it, kill themselves. Whereas the rich over in Sweden do far, far better, which is why they stay in Sweden. I mean, why would a rich person stay? And we're saying, why do they stay in these more equal countries?
We don't make decisions based on rationality.
No, I do think it'll be hard. I mean, I think there will be strikes. There will be strikes as there are in Ireland. There will be great big referendums as there are in Iceland. There's going to be lots of turmoil. I think that's likely to happen. But I think it would help to at least try to win over a small proportion. And by the rich, I'm talking about 1 in 10 people, and probably half this room. Yeah, and inequality means you don't think you're rich. You know, if you're looking at a household income in this room of over £45,000-£50,000, you and your significant other, then you're way up there in the top tenth of society. If you go and ask you to identify yourselves, so You know, I'm talking about converting you. And if you already don't see yourself as that, you know, you actually don't have to give up very much if you doubt, that's the good news. Other ways of doing it. Things become possible in a crisis. I'm not wishing a crisis, but supposing we do have a double-dip recession. Suppose the Conservatives come in. George Osborne opens the books and says, it's truly awful, it's terrible, they were lying, it's much worse. Just in case, imagine he would do that. Right? And there's a run on the pound. And I'm not sure whether they join a euro parity. I don't think the Conservatives like Europe, so we go below parity. Right? It's truly awful. What the hell do you do then? And you've got IMF. What does Cameron and George do? I have a fantasy that they then introduce a land tax as the only possible way of raising money because you can't handle land. And they know all their friends have got land, so they know where it is. But so I'll show them. My land tax, 70p a square metre, or 7p a square metre for 10 years. Think about how much land you've got, even if you're renting. 7p a square metre, you could afford it, couldn't you? Okay, let's weight it by the average value of the land. You're in Sheffield, so that's the same, because this is average land for Britain. But if you're the Duke of Westminster, it's a hell of a lot. But anyway, 7p per square metre for 10 years, that's 175 billion. It's paid it off. And if you can't pay it, you can sell your land to a Russian or an American who will buy it still. It won't happen, but these kind of things only happen in an absolute terrible crisis. But that's not impossible, because you can't. The poor don't have any money, and we can't give them any more debt. We can't create a new kind of subprime mortgage and get away with it. 36% of people are going to university, right? Not that stupid. And what, 2% of those people can be really rich? So what's the other 34% of people going to think? I mean, I can talk myself into optimism in various ways like this, because what is different to the last time we had a crash is that we actually have enough money to easily have a good life for everybody in the country. We have enough houses, enough cars, enough bedrooms we didn't have back then. And that makes a change.
That's borrowed
money. None of these things exist. The sewers are built
on the basis of borrowed money. We're in a massive deficit at the moment.
Do you mind? Because I do want to make sure other people do have a chance to speak as well. In a minute. Okay, if I just move on.
Okay.
you said that crises could result in things changing quite rapidly. It appears to me that there's plenty of potential for multiple crises to unfold in the next few years. In terms of the energy situation, you know, the UK is obviously clearly well past peak fossil fuel production. At the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the UK had more fossil fuel energy than Saudi Arabia did. It looks like we've globally passed peak oil production. So there's a big energy crisis looming. There's the climate situation, environmental destruction, ecological collapse. I mean, the kind of sum total of human activity on the planet looks to me as if we're actually in the process of destroying the biosphere and on course to render the planet uninhabitable. So I think there's lots of potential crises. Do you think any of these crises might, you know, result in something positive in terms of equality and stuff?
I think either they do or we've had it. I mean, if you just project it forward, in the last 10 years, the GDP of America doubled. It's not that America made more stuff or did more useful things. It just claimed its banks were more efficient and its GDP doubled. And you can't, if you run that forward, you can't. You just can't do that. I do take your point about the loans and so on. And we do have to do enough that we give to the rest of the world that they want to give us stuff back. And we've been doing it with banking. I mean, and it was a great trick. It was, you know, you put your money here, we'll look after it safely, we'll make it grow a bit and we'll give it back to you. And that cut will trickle down. And the cut did trickle down in some ways. I just don't think the world is that stupid to come back and give so much of its money to British banks again. I don't think it is. And that's what the plan of all three parties is. There is no alternative. We will have public sector cuts. And all the banks will be privatised again, and it's there's no plan B. And I'm old and boring enough, and I have kids that I might vote for if I thought it. I don't think it's going to work. And we'd reached a point when these banks are so big and they're doing such dodgy things to keep on making the cash, that the idea that you can go back to that again, then we have to do something else that is of use to other people in the world to be able to get them to send us our things. And we should also stop doing things like buying enormous amounts of stuff from China that we don't want, which is Christmas Day, if you've got kids, just, you know, what you open on Christmas Day, all that stuff, which they hate 1 hour later, comes from China. And we buy it because our debt indirectly is with China. And we could kind of make a deal with China where we buy fewer things and they let us off a bit of our debt. I mean, that in effect is what happens when you get poorer. And we've got dramatically poorer in the last 2 years. We just don't feel it because we've been printing money for 12 months.
If I may ask a question with a slightly international slant, I wonder whether an increased international appreciation of the data you've shown about the disparity in the top and bottom earners in rich countries in the world would reduce the so-called brain drain of highly skilled migrant workers from working in the region. The reason I ask this is based on somewhat personal experience and also based on anecdotal evidence. So much to go on, but what people in developing world sort of look at is at the rich countries is, you know, yes, I'd like to have a car and a nice house and for my family, and that's what they look at. But whether if they came to know that actually we're okay where we are, because actually, you know, we don't need to move to the richest countries because we may not be as, you know, as well, we're probably more unequal in terms of where we stand in society. So, what your comment would be on that?
Okay, I'd agree, but I'd take a very local example to see how it works. This has been going on geographically within Britain for 4 decades. So, if you arrive at a new university and you think, I'm a geography professor, I don't want to live where all the other professors live, I want to try and live somewhere clever. Most towns had a clever place where the locals would live. Then you suddenly find people say, oh, but the schools, they're going downhill there, they're going uphill there. This, and you end up spending as much as you can to buy a house in one area. It's the same as moving internationally, because you're scared about the future. You're told if you spend as much as you can in the house, it'll make the most. Your children will do better. There'll be less crime. This area and this other part of town, it might be okay now, but it might well go down. Whereas if you had a sense that the country was coming together again, as it was in Britain for the 30s, 40s, 50s and 60s, then the sensible thing wouldn't be to buy a house in the poshest area because you'd actually do less well than if you bought a house in a more average area. It's happened to an extreme extent in the States, and this is why we spend half our income now on housing. So my grandparents spent a tenth of theirs and half on food. We're not buying the houses. You know, it's not because these houses are very, very pretty houses. We're buying the address. We're buying the address because of fear. It's the same for international migration. And if you don't bring it down, you end up just stoking up a city. Eventually it has to crash. I mean, you just have to run this thing forward. You know, you cannot carry on forever that the prices go up most. Prices are still going up in the poshest bits of London, by the way, house prices. But it can't. You end up with a Blade Runner scenario, which I don't think we're going to get to. And internationally it's similar. And I mean, I think we're also going to see it. We'll begin to see it. Because if you look at salaries in Britain from abroad now, which of course we don't see, you're suddenly looking at coming here for 30% less money. And that's changing a lot of people's attitudes to coming, whereas you can get better money in Germany or better money in Canada. So why would you, if you're a doctor, why would you come to Britain? So we end up still hiring doctors from abroad, but we hired a dodgy doctor from abroad who doesn't have any sleep, and you know the story on telly, right? And it's not good. Here's from Germany, by the way.
You're next.
I wondered if you, I think someone else talked about the kind of fear that if we tax rich people too much, they'll leave and then we won't get what the money they're bringing into the country or whatever anymore. And I wonder if you could just kind of address that and ask you, are rich people really that important? Would it, if they all upped and left and went to all these other places which are nicer or they got paid more, what would be the effect?
Okay, but they've gone already. I mean, they already go. So there's a trial of a hedge fund manager in Costa Rica who was murdered. Did you listen to the news? He built a fortress out there, like a James Bond house, if somebody's still got to him. But the rich don't stay. I mean, Branson has Necker Island. You know, Cliff Richard goes off. You know, I mean, they come back to London because that's where the parties are. But they don't actually stay. Philip Green's wife, with all the money, she's in Monaco. So they've gone, and they went a long time ago. And their money's out. Anyway, and I hope Tracy Emin does go. That's my personal thought. <that much. laughs> So I wouldn't worry about that, but when you come to taxing wealth, I would concentrate on taxing land because you can't make it. And that, if you like, solves that problem. You can tax incomes. I mean, the United States in the 1950s had a 51% tax on income, and it didn't do the United States that much damage in the 1950s or 60s. It's just changing attitudes to what it is seen as acceptable to do. The cap idea, if there's a way of doing it, is far, far more effective because of how we rank ourselves relatively. So if you say that the person who runs the hospital there or the university there or the great big DWP building there, if they can't be paid more than 150,000, they don't want anybody else paid more than them, of course. And you can see what the effect is. It's a massive saving on money. They're still the richest people in Sheffield. They're just not on the same amount.
And well, this is the secret of Japan, isn't it? They've got that income confession.
Yes, they've got that. But partly, yes. And it affects all kinds of things. When I was doing some teaching in Japan, and I was going to jump in a taxi for £7 to go and do my teaching, and my Japanese colleagues looked at me like I was dirty. What are you doing that for? There's a bus. And because you're much more equal, you all behave more similarly in Japan. And it's a shock. And you get used to it after a bit, and it's normal, and then you take the bus. But it's, and then Japan isn't a utopia, but it's managed to squeeze 120 million people into far, far less land than we have with far less trouble. Because there isn't this idea that you're disrespected or that you're worth more than other people, so you should look down on them as much. And one effect is just how mixed the neighbourhoods are. It's a real shock to find that people choose where they want to live because they actually like the place, or it's near some kind of temple or something. And you take your child to school on the bike because you go to the nearest school, because it doesn't make any sense. Why would you want to go to a school that isn't the nearest school? I mean, what's the sense in that?
Matt.
Well, this is not so much a question as a response to the comments about wanting to increase equality without in any way taxing the rich. It was mentioned in the talk that in London, for example, 1 in 10 people have £1 million or more pounds, and 1 in 10 have £3,000. Just how much are we going to have to raise the people on £3,000 to compress inequality to get them near to a level of people with £1 million? I'm not sure where my money's going to come from. How much are we going to have to raise the minimum wage for that to happen? Saying, oh yeah, we've got to raise people. Yeah, it's a nice aim, and yeah, we've got to try and do that, but saying we've got to raise people and we can't in any way take any wealth off the people right at the top, it just seems to be an argument to do nothing. And it's just a nice soundbite, but how do you get the figures about it? How are we going to get the people with £3,000 close to people with £1 million without in any way taking a bit from the people with £1 million?
Yes, sir.
I thought all of your examples and slides were amazing, but to be honest, in a way, I'd say that what they're demonstrating is that using a kind of inequality yardstick is a fascinating way to measure and describe the sort of chaos, in a way, of our society. But when you flip from there to talk about how to get towards more equality or back towards previous better state of it, sort of assumes that we're in a society that is actually pursuing it, and I don't think we are, because I think that with an ever liberalised, deregularised market, what's actually going on is that what we used to call democracy has become just a sort of chaotic situation to govern and to control, and I think that government tends to sort of dangle down bits of sort of equality from time to time to make it a bit more manageable when we all get a bit noisy about it, or at the bottom if you like, we kind of wave a flag of equality if we're feeling a bit aggrieved because we aren't getting opportunities to get our share. So these are quite sort of, they're not really very grand motives for pursuit of equality, it seems to be. And so I'm kind of with the guy over here in a way that's saying that it's all this greed thing that runs through, obviously, the through capitalist way of looking at things. And unless we actually can flip that towards the opposite, which I suppose is generosity, I don't think we're even going to begin to start along any sort of road towards the case for equality. And if you take the delusional view about religion and or sort of all morality or something like that, then he poses a very serious question. You know, how do you get a society based on generosity again, which would follow more collective sort of views about things, that you could then start talking about the pursuit of equality as a real thing?
Well,
I just one small thing. When you started off the lecture and you mentioned the Japanese kids that you're asking and you're doing this kind of thing, it actually, you seem to say it's really fascinating how they answer, but I didn't get quite what their answer was, and I wondered if it had any purchase on my point.
Yes. I'm just going to take one last contribution because someone.
And unless there's anybody else who hasn't spoken.
Yeah. Is there anyone who hasn't spoken who really wants to make a contribution? Okay. Because I was just going to. It's 9:30 now, so I thought we'd just be winding things up. So I'll just take.
There's an area of inequality that I always find very interesting. I don't know if it relates to what you've been describing here, or about its causes. It's just something that I observe, and it's an active rejection of a whole cluster of things like education, culture, and all the things that you would probably find most people around this room would think were broadly good things. And there is almost a I'm not making generalities about society. I'm talking about specific people that I know, and including within my own family. They say, I don't read. No, I don't read books. Why would I want to listen to music? Why would I want to listen to that? And I don't know what drives it. Whether it's sort of fear of anything that might remotely be seen as intellectual, but it seems to start for some kids in school with a rejection of anything to do with academic attendance, and I have no idea whether it's to do with facilities, ability, or whether it's more likely to be connected with things like the kind of aspiration and expectations that they have in their home. It's just something that I find really very interesting and strange, and I wonder if it connects in any way that you can explain with what you've been describing.
Okay.
Yeah,
pass something to either of those two. The answers I got from the Japanese people is only about 25. It takes a hell of a long time interviewing people in Japanese because you say it in English and then somebody says something for 5 minutes in Japanese. They say something back for 5 minutes and they say yes. but the amazing thing is these questions about how many cars do you think these people have? How many, apart from that, people don't have cars if you live in the city. It's not about income, it's do you live in the city, you don't have a car. Which is hard for us to understand. The amazing thing was that the answers were remarkably similar to people in very different situations. They knew about other people's lives, and the span was much smaller. Now, one question I ask new students, 18-year-old students, and I've worked in 4 universities, it's not just Sheffield, is when was the last time you've been on the bus? Because I want to find out what proportion have never been on the bus in their life, about university students. And it's not just in Britain that the poorest people have no idea about the life and average income and so on of the rich. The affluent people, which is the bulk of university students in the university like the one we are in the pub of, have very little idea. They have very little idea what benefit levels are, what average incomes are, and so on. They're out by orders of magnitude. We're just ignorant of each other's lives because they are so very, very different. I mean, £9 a day is JSA if you're over £25. £9 a day for your food, your cigarettes, your clothes. It's like not thinking about death. I mean, it's easy to get through life if you don't think about dying. As human beings, we don't think about dying. But now we don't also think, if you've got a well-paid job, about living on benefit. That's one difference. it kind of relates to your question in a way. I mean, I went to a school which was an average school, and that's one way in which Britain's changed. You know, at least you can now get out of average schools and so on because it was comprehensive. So otherwise I'd have failed 11 plus. But only 6 of us went to university out of 300, and most children were like how you describe, because they were sensible. Because what was the point of reading books and aspiring to things? Because what happened to boys in my year was you went and worked in a car factory, in the Rover car factory, and we were taught to use the lathes. And we were taught two hours a day how to use lathes, because that's what you do. But my year was the last year that they ever took on boys in the car factory. It was the last year of apprenticeships. But it was a sensible thing, because you would be living in such a fantasy world if you thought that you'd get into that 2% who might be allowed to be cultured then. The gaps are just as big nowadays of what's happened to you. So the good news, I keep forgetting about the good news, it was completely missed. A report came out last week which said, well, we've been monitoring who gets to university for years and years and years. A report came out last week that said, finally, partly by accident, maybe largely by accident, for the first time ever, a majority of ex-university places in Britain went to children from the poorest half of areas. Wasn't expected, completely unexpected by ministers. It's a whole mixture of things, but largely fewer 18-year-olds being born 18 years ago to middle-class parents, which helps a lot. They're in such disarray. They're in complete disarray. So they didn't realise it was coming. They didn't claim the credit for maybe the one thing they've actually helped. Instead, they announced the most massive cuts ever a day after to university budgets, which they didn't have to do to look at the weight of the budget. I mean, they are in complete and utter disarray. There's a bit in The Guardian about it, saying, you know, finally something's... I wrote it. I tried to get The Telegraph, it failed. I tried to get The Mail, it failed. Eventually I got in The Guardian. Wrote a bit saying, finally something's happened that's actually good compared to the war and everything else that's bad. And there are now something like 150 comments underneath going, we don't believe you, it's crap, these are useless courses, it's more debt. And you read this. This government's in unbelievable disarray.
I think this is probably true, what you're saying about the proportional number of working class kids going to universities. But we've got to remember that higher education is highly stratified.
Yes.
We have to ask which university.
It is, but it's doubled from bright side. It's going to happen. I mean, Ham's bloody good university. I won't get again about myself control. But there are more children going from bright side than going from the constituency in which I grew up in Oxford East, because Oxford Brookes hasn't got the spaces, because posh children want to go to Oxford Brookes because it's called Oxford Brookes. That is Oxford Poly. Posh Southerners aren't going in large numbers to Sheffield Hallam, so there are places. But this is a doubling that's happened in 5 years, and your chances of going, because they built Longley Park, because there's actually education at age 16 and 17 in a quarter of this city that didn't have it, and they're in such disarray that they can't even take credit for it. And when they do take credit, people say, we think you're lying because we know you lie about everything else, particularly that war.
Well, look, I'd like to thank Danny once again. Before you go, there's a couple of things to note.